tomorrow all the things were gone. I'd worked for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, where the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today. Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. This land.
God bless the USA.
God bless the USA.
Well, good morning, Thumper.
Good morning, Dan. Good to see you.
Well, good to see you. I want to, again, thank Lee Greenwood and the Singing Sergeants from the Air Force for that beautiful opening song. And today we've got a great program. I've got a friend. I'd call him an old friend, but he isn't that old. He's just he's been a friend a long time. And that's Michael Shaw. Michael is joining us for the first hour. And then the second hour, we're going to have Dr. Shiva on, and we're going to continue the thought. And Michael is probably one of the most, probably the most knowledgeable people in the entire world on UN Agenda 21. Certainly one of the most knowledgeable people on how it's impacted California, because it's had a huge impact on his own personal life and his land, his property. As a matter of fact, what was happening in the One Bay area is the reason that Michael even got involved with the freedom movement on UN Agenda 21. And so we're going to be talking this morning about the impacts, what Agenda 21, 2030 really is, and how that those impacts are now coming home to roost in the United States. And even though our opening song is, I'm proud to be an American because at least I know we're free, the fact is we aren't free anymore unless we stand up and fight for our rights to remain free. And Michael's going to be talking about just how important that really is. Michael, good morning and welcome to the program.
Well, good morning, Dan. It's certainly a pleasure to be with you today.
Well, I was so tickled the other day to find out that you and Joanne are getting close to getting your Arizona project off the ground and really getting back into Arizona and get out of California. I don't blame you one little bit for wanting to do that.
Well, I certainly do want to leave California. It's not the state that I've lived in. I moved here when I was 4 years old, so it's been a long time, and it's been a great place to live. But the last 25 years, things have really deteriorated to the point where, you know, you've got a very restrictive one-party state, high tax, limited freedom, and you know, private property has essentially been abolished in California under the Agenda 21 pro forma that has advanced so far and so thoroughly in this state. And it's a sad condition, because I will always think that there's not much more of a beautiful place than California in the world, but politics makes a huge difference in one's life. And even if you're not particularly involved in politics, the effects that political systems can have on one's being are huge. And that's why so many others have left and are leaving this once great state. But of late, it certainly hasn't lived up to its potential. And that's why we're eager to get to Arizona. And, you know, that will end one chapter and begin another in our lives.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm looking forward to you being in Arizona in the winter the same time my wife and I are here, because we're not exactly neighbors since you're going to be up in Prescott, but I still plan to make sure we get a chance to see you and Joanne a lot more often. and give us an opportunity to visit a little bit. And we'll do it at least on the trip down and the trip back, and hopefully a few trips in between. But tell people how you got started in the whole process, how you were actually involved, because you owned a beautiful piece of property at Santa Cruz that was like a major, beachfront property, and how that your involvement with the Planning Commission and how you found out about just exactly how diabolical and bad UN Agenda 21 is.
Well, it all started in the mid-80s when my wife and I had just moved to Santa Cruz from the Bay Area. And, Santa Cruz is a beautiful spot with delightful weather and broad, expansive beaches. And so we bought 70 acres, not on the beach, but back a short distance, a couple of beautiful hills that run with a creek in the middle and a nice valley floor and just a wonderful piece of property. And this was, of course, before Agenda 21 had even been announced to the world. But Santa Cruz was a leader in those policies going back to the 70s. And, I had some familiarity with the strangeness of Santa Cruz even before I moved there. But, being young and vibrant, I thought we could maybe take a part in changing the world, or at least in changing Santa Cruz. But, I was in something deeper than I understood. And by the 90s, when Agenda 21 rolled out, and I became fully aware of that impact in about 2000. And, after 15 years of not being able to use my land at all, I just kept battling and actually brought a condemnation suit against the county of Santa Cruz. And at that time, and up until 6 months ago, the courts required that you exhaust any kind of condemnation activity at state court level before you can bring a federal Fifth Amendment claim. And so I learned what that really meant. And that meant that you had to have local judges who were, dependent and part of county government. And of course, I had no chance of winning. I lost, and the state appeals court, rubber stamped that. And so I began another couple decades of fighting against what I was up against until a couple years ago when I put the property on the market. And now finally it's in escrow at a huge loss to myself, because the county has really rendered that property, at least as to me, essentially valueless. And in the interim, we converted that property into the most glorious native plant oasis probably in the whole state of California. I mean, it is generally recognized. It's been on the cover of international environmental magazines for its remarkable native plant recovery. And it's just a gorgeous place, but subject to a political cloud unlike most people can even begin to imagine, because what happened in Santa Cruz to me is now happening to people all over the country as Agenda 21 has fully implemented itself in every city, every county in this country. And of course, nowhere as thoroughly and deeply as it has in California. So it's been a hard and in many ways a sad dynamic to deal with the reality of how the political system has deteriorated in this country so drastically since Agenda 21 was adopted in 1992. Mm-hmm. So here we are today to talk about it a little bit and share some information with listeners around the world.
Well, I think right now, if people realize it or not, California is the poster child for what UN Agenda 21 is going to be like around the world. And even though they haven't fully implemented everything that they plan to do under Agenda 21, Michael, as you well know, there's massive population reduction as part of UN Agenda 21 on top of all the other things they've got planned. But what's happening now in California on the restrictions of private property, I think most people, they really don't get it. We don't own our property. We haven't owned property in this country since they extinguished the idea of a loyal title, a lodial title. That was a lodial meant that it was beyond the reach of the king and queen. It's a term from really common law under the English system. And now we have deeds of trust, and we have things that are different than having real, honest to goodness ownership of your land. And I tell people, if you think you own your land, don't pay your taxes for 2 years, and then you'll find out real quick how much you actually own, because the state, in essence, owned your property, but they've been somewhat subtle about it. Now, under UN Agenda 21, they really, truly want to extinguish all property rights. Kind of explain to our listeners how that process works.
Well, it can work in so many ways. In my own case, the county went and built a pond on property not far from my property. And in this pond, they planted so-called long-toed salamanders. It's a little species that the state of California and the county of Santa Cruz got declared endangered. So this little thing will crawl to its seasonal habitat away from a pond, say a mile away. So when the county goes and builds one of these ponds and stocks it with salamanders, they then can lay a claim on any parcel within a mile's radius as being salamander habitat. And of course, they are claiming that with respect to my property and even with respect to the proposed buyer. And once they can successfully assert that, then they can just lay claim to all controls with respect to that property. So what we have is situations where the county can, where the government can actually go out and plant these species near your property and then claim the species goes onto your property. And now your property really is not yours. It is the species property, and the government's there to protect that species. And that's just destroys all economic viability to so-called land ownership. It really vests as much control into our government as any Soviet government ever had over its citizens and its landmass. And that's really where America is today. The Endangered Species Act has been used so destructively over land use and land rights that the America of today is not recognizable from what was America, say, 130 years ago, before we had so much political overtake over matters such as land rights. And once you've denied citizen ownership and authority over land use, you might as well be living in the Soviet Union in 1960, because mm-hmm. that's how that system worked. We know where it ended up. That's where our system's going to end up if we're not careful. And, when you combine that with the monetary realities of today and the government creation of fiat or paper or phony money, you have a double whammy of government taking over all land property interests and government creating a monetary system that is not one that can stand on its own 2 feet, nor one that can last. And you have a population then that is doomed to a very hard and horrible political structure that worsens by the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sure does. Well, I know our listeners, we've got a very educated group of listeners, but we've talked about this in the past, but the Club of Rome in 1965 met at Rockefeller's estate in just outside of Rome. And the group, which included, incidentally, Al Gore Sr., and a number of internationalists that were part of this cabal or this group, came up with the idea that environmentalism would be the glue that they would use to pull the world into a, let's say, a new dynamic that would cause the world to unite under a one-world socialist system. And they created a paper, a white paper that came out of that called Limits to Growth. And it outlined the whole plan for basically a world where environmentalism becomes the new religion for the world. And they use it as a way to hold the rest of really humanity under a veil of control. And from that sprang, incidentally, the EPA, the Endangered Species Act, the obvious idea of land use planning, and all the parcels of the American Planning Association that have gone into much of UN Agenda 21. They have been one of the main contributors to the program, the American Planning Association, through programs like ICLEI, the International Council on Local Environmental Initiatives, and many other programs that have been implemented. People think this is a fairly new thing. It's not. It's been going on since the late 60s and early 70s. Now, Michael, you've talked about different organizations, different non-governmental organizations, different programs that have been implemented to through COGS, councils of government, to take away local control and create more control by unelected bureaucrats. Talk a little bit to our listeners about how that whole process has kind of evolved from the ideas from the Club of Rome.
Well, today, COGS, I think COGS are the key focus in that discussion. A COG is a council of government. Now, councils of government were created back in the 1950s by Dwight Eisenhower, of all people. COG is a regional organization that is formed on basically every square inch of land in the United States. There's some lands, federal lands, in places like Montana that don't have COGs, but those areas also don't have population. But a COG, for instance, one COG, really the leading COG at this point in the United States, is the San Francisco Bay Area COG, called ABAG, the Association of Bay Area Governments. And this COG is has now come out with a plan, the One Bay Area Plan, that negates the power of all city and county governments in the Bay Area to control and zone and manage the land use decisions. Instead, all that power and more is vested in the COG. Now, the COG is made up of some elected officials. They're not elected to the COG. They're elected to city council or to the county board of supervisors. And then they get appointed by the COG to the COG. So the people who are appointed to COGs are people who are in support of the concept of unelected regional government. Now, you can take any metropolitan or any rural area in America, and there is a COG, generally a multi-countied organization with people appointed by the COG to itself to make all the rules for that region. It's really a very undemocratic, un-American republic notion of government. It is a Soviet style of government, and it is one that is in place now. Now, when Eisenhower created this in the 1950s, he did it for purposes of developing the interstate highway system. Well, we all like our freeways, but there was never any authority under the Constitution for the federal government to create a a national freeway system, one of the few powers that the government had on a federal level under the Constitution, is the creation of the post office. The rightful thing for the government to have done back in the 1950s was to have a constitutional amendment that allowed them to build these highways. Well, what really happened was a prototype was established for the federal control of local operations. And that now is expanding through ABAG to control all land use decisions, all transportation decisions made for that region by this regional outfit called a COG. And so what we have in the Bay Area is all cities are losing their power over anything. All power is being vested in the COG, the ABAG organization. And they have a very detailed plan at this point for the full implementation of this COG program. Now, I and my friend Rosa Corey brought a lawsuit in order to stop this process. Well, we lost our trial case on very bogus grounds. I don't think the judge had any idea what was going on, or at least he pretended not to know. And we appealed that to the state appellate court. And after sitting on the case, fully briefed for about 3 years, the court suddenly mooted the case and threw us out without a published decision, or any discussion at any level of the facts that we brought. They did this because they claimed that the COG had changed their program and that the changes in the program mooted our case. Well, it was a complete decision where the result guided the courts. And they just dropped this case like a hot potato, and the COG today just rolls forward. Now, wherever you live, your COG is in advance of the same ends. No COG has gone as far as the Bay Area. It makes sense that California's Bay Area would be the one that would lead the country in connection with the creation of this kind of political organization. But now it's free and unfettered and is rolling forward. And within the next few years, national news is going to be made about how the Bay Area COG has taken over all political decision-making and all authority away from cities and counties, effectively regionalizing government. Now, that's the whole idea of a Soviet government, is to regionalize authority. So you've got nebulous boundaries, you've got nebulous concepts that can be implemented differently at will by this unelected, unaccountable board that controls all local action. And all Americans should be concerned about what's happening in the Bay Area, because what's happening there will happen where you are. It's just a matter of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're right. And they've got similar programs in the other large urban areas of California. I know Los Angeles, San Diego, all of these areas have these similar COGs in process right now. They just aren't as fully developed as they are in the One Bay Area COG.
That's absolutely right. Every inch in California is covered by a COG. There's 38 COGs in total, with the Bay Area and Los Angeles and San Diego, of course, being the largest in terms of representing population. But the farm communities are all part of a COG. The coastal communities are all part of a COG. And that's the case across the country. It is the case wherever it is you live. There is a COG there. If you do some research under Council of Government for your area, you'll find where it is, who's on it, and how they meet, and how they're progressing with their total plan to take over your local government.
Yeah, one of the things that comes out of this idea of COGS, and we've talked about this, is that they completely eliminate local decision-making and elected officials. And in the process of doing that, when they get rid of the citizens being able to determine who represents them in their government, then they have a lot more power to be able to do things that are patently unconstitutional. And the one thing that people need to understand is that your local county commissioners, your local government, even your local school boards eventually will be taken over by these cogs, and all decision making will come from a much higher plane and filter down. In other words, this top-down government is the antithesis of what our founding fathers envisioned for a country, which was local citizens, bottom-up government. And that's exactly what you're talking about. The Soviet model is the model for this. And the people who are trying to implement UN Agenda 21 and all the globalist ideas are people who also supported the UN, and they were part of the architecture of the UN, and that was controlled by communists, wasn't it?
Well, you know, that's right. And, you know, the totalitarian regimes of the world have gathered steam while they've pretended to have stepped back. You know, the Soviets and in Russia, et cetera, they've appeared to have stepped back. The communists in China have made appearances of working with the world and joining the world economy. But in fact, they're all really lying in wait for a for the fall of America and for a total revision of world economics, world politics under a unitary system of one world government. And if we're not careful, we're going to fall into that trap. You know, my sense, though, is that Americans are waking up. The understanding of Agenda 21 has spread rather thoroughly and has caused great frustration of the globalists in respect to how America has reacted with its national leadership, I mean, up until the election of Joe Biden. And, you know, there's a much greater awareness today than 15 years ago about what we face and what our alternatives really are. And I have some great hope that Americans will wake up and that they will be saved, and that you know, the frauds that rise up to take control of our life, the frauds that rise up to ruin our middle class, are frauds that are being exposed, and that will be and the good guys will rise up and win the day in the end. But we each need to play our role in being part of that good guy team in order for all that to occur, because the alternative is that the world population will be tremendously shrunk, that transhumanism will take effect and work to alter the nature of humanity itself, and that total centralized control will be exerted on a global level. And that's a very ugly future. And we need to understand it, recognize it, fight back. I mean, these viruses that we're being inflicted with can be a continuing major harassment to the achievement of all things that are good. To me, it's a the virus epidemic is a telltale sign of the extent to which the globalists will operate in order to take us down as individual thinkers and individual beings with natural rights that imbue to us, not because of government grant, but because of godly grant. And
yeah, I agree. Michael, I know, as a matter of fact, you've got a PowerPoint you were talking about sharing, and it's something that I've been aware of for some time, but it's becoming pretty obvious that this plandemic, the whole thing has been literally planned for, the last 4 years. And you have a part, you've got a PowerPoint program, but do you have a video you want to share with our listeners and viewers talking about that?
Well, I don't. I apologize for that, but I can. I think it's clear that people understand that this pandemic came about after manipulation first in the United States, and then the gain of function activity, which had been outlawed for research by Congress, was shipped off to China, where it was completed and released upon first Chinese and as it grew out upon the whole world. And it's given a lot of centralized power to those people we don't want to give centralized power to. Mm-hmm. And it's left us in a rather vulnerable position today, as we can anticipate that viral infections will be a continuing fact of life for an undeterminable period of time. And in that process, it's the wish of the globalists that the human population be controlled.
Be controlled and be radically reduced. And that's the thing that people need to understand, is that under UN Agenda 21, we will see human populations reduced by 93%, according to the percentages, because they're talking to under a billion people. And in some of the things that I've read that they've put out, they're actually saying a half a billion people, so 500 million people. Now, people need to understand that they're also in this pandemic scenario and this vaccine scenario. Now they're talking about you will be required to take their vaccine before you can travel, before you can go to the grocery store, before you can do anything. I don't know. A large percentage of our viewers and listeners are Bible-believing Christians. If that isn't straight out of the book of Revelation, I don't know what is.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about that. But let me give some support for your assertion that the population will be reduced by those kinds of numbers. There is a one of the Agenda 21 books is this thick tome called the Global Biodiversity Report book. Mm-hmm. This is an over 1,000 page book. They're big, dense pages. And let me read a quote from page 773 from that book. There it says that a reasonable estimate for an industrialized world society in the present North American material standard of living would be 1 billion people. Now, you referenced some numbers which you can find in other places that indicate a number of less than 1 billion people. But right there in black and white, under the Agenda 21 protocol, is a call for a reduction of human population to 1 billion people. Now, you know, these people are really diabolical in the Agenda 21 pro forma. They actually call for a reduction in population. They say there in Agenda 21 itself, they say that countries ought to develop plans for priority action, which are based on cooperative planning by the various levels of government, non-governmental organizations, and local communities. An appropriate organization such as WHO, the World Health Organization, should coordinate these activities. Well, just to trace the history on that a bit, you know, Donald Trump, one of the first actions he took was to take us out of WHO. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden, the first action he took was to put us back inside WHO. So here we are on full stage implementation of Agenda 21 under the current regime in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. picking up the pace right back where Barack Obama left off. And here we have WHO being vested with all this power and authority. And we see that the ultimate goal is a massive reduction in human population. And so one has to say, why is America and Americans putting up with this? You know, how can it be that an obviously senile fella can go and throw us back into this ugly world of 2002 when the WHO organization and the United Nations are pushing us full steam into this massive depopulation scenario mm-hmm. and massive control situation with the abolition of private property happening all around us at every turn, with California taking the lead and the Bay Area leading California. We're in a tough spot. But the good news is that people are increasingly aware of it. I think over the next 3 or 4 years, people are going to become massively aware, and reactions are going to happen. I don't think we're going to see a continuation of the Democrat Party in control of Washington, D.C. for very long. And if I'm wrong about that, we're in deep trouble. As a, mm-hmm. as one, a guy who had been a lifetime Democrat, I am not anymore. It's very disheartening to see how a political party can take this country and 240 years of advance and of good things happening, and it's suddenly just being filtered away by mm-hmm. powercrats who just want to have authority and control over you, me, and everybody else. And this is something that we all have to just stand up and say, no more.
Well, we know that shadow banned. We've been censored in a big way for being one of the networks, the Patriot Soapbox Network, being one of the networks that talks about the rigged elections, about the plandemic, about a lot of those things. We've had a huge amount of censorship from social media. But the fact is, I think virtually everybody that has a brain bigger than a pea realizes that this election was a stolen election. This election, there's no way that a guy who hid in the basement, who couldn't get a automobile rally bigger than 16 cars, was going to beat Trump when Trump was attracting anywhere from 15 to 50,000 people every time he went and had an event, had a rally. It just doesn't make any sense. And we have had our election system stolen. The problem is if they actually, well, they've passed House Resolution 1, and they're trying to push that same bill through the Senate, it will create a scenario where we'll never have another honest election ever. And in fact, we probably won't anyway, unless we get rid of the computerized voting and make voter registration and identification of individuals to vote have that in place. If we don't do that, we'll never have another honest election as long as we live, will we?
Well, that's a real concern. But along with that is the existence of the cogs. You don't need an election if you've got a cog in your community, and you do have a cog in your community. And so we're under threat from multiple perspectives as this globalist movement steals authority.
Yeah. Well, you talked about the World Health Organization. There are a lot of other organizations like that. And for whatever you think of Trump, the bottom line is he got rid of a lot of this stuff. And I do believe he was a true nationalist and believed in the United States of America as a constitutional republic. And what has happened since Biden has been in office, I mean, he's literally rescinded almost everything that Trump accomplished in 4 years.
Well, that's true. But, you know, Trump, in some sense, set himself up. You know, once he began their program of human curtailment as a result of this virus, I mean, when human history has a virus precipitated the kinds of shutdown that we've seen in America, shutdowns that were designed to eliminate major segments of the middle class. If they are successful in abolishing the middle class, it makes their path very simple to ride forward to this, basic income for all dynamic and the other outrageous communistic, socialistic endeavors that are being planned right now. And Trump certainly opened the door for that. And one can say he was duped. He might have been duped by his daughter and son-in-law. He might have just been duped by the forces of politics in the modern era. But I think that he certainly did make some wrong moves in respect to reaction to this virus dynamic, which has been a reaction the likes of which human history has never seen. And there's certainly been plenty of viruses that have afflicted the world in the past, but none have been treated with the same kind of total control that this one has resulted in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I don't know if you saw this, but I just read an article that a friend of mine from California sent about how the Russian medical system, they've actually, in spite of the fact that the World Health Organization made it illegal, believe it or not, illegal to perform autopsies on COVID, people who supposedly die from COVID. And the Russians have been performing autopsies on these bodies and discovered that it is a blood bacteria that causes clotting in the cardiovascular system, and that it's very easy to eliminate by basically just 100 milligram aspirin per day will stop the COVID. It's absolutely amazing how many things we're starting to find out about this. And I've had friends that have died who they blame it on COVID and they didn't have COVID. But anytime you put an incentive, an economic incentive in the form of $15,000 for every hospital that identifies a COVID death, and every hospital that puts anybody on a respirator, you're going to get $40,000. I mean, this is such a bogus thing, the way they're doing this whole program. It's pretty obvious that the deck is stacked to try to create COVID deaths rather than to try to identify legitimate COVID deaths. And incidentally, I don't know if you've noticed that, but deaths from flu have disappeared.
Totally disappeared.
Deaths from cardiovascular conditions have disappeared. Everything now is a COVID death. And we've had fewer deaths in 2020 than we had in 2019 and 2018. Isn't that fascinating with this huge pandemic going on that we had fewer deaths the year of the pandemic?
Well, I think we've all been duped into a dynamic that's leaving us quite exposed to what the next step might be in this global population takedown, in this total Agenda 21 takeover of government. And it's time for us to rattle and wake up and do something about this. It's interesting though that the pandemic follows a pattern that was really predicted or written about in 2017, in the so-called SPAR research and theory that came out of John Hopkins University. And this was a program that all the big players were involved in, from Bill Gates to Fauci. And in 2017, SPARS, which is the St. Paul It was a pandemic that broke out in St. Paul, Minnesota. In theory, this is a futuristic design laid out by these engineers a pandemic hits St. Paul and spreads from there. And the whole program of what happened with COVID is laid out in a 90-page document produced at John Hopkins University that told us exactly what was going to happen and exactly what the reaction would be. And then as COVID came out 2 years later, it follows the exact course that was predicted in the SARS pandemic. Here's a copy of the booklet produced. It's called the SARS pandemic. It's a futuristic scenario for public health risk communications. And the dates for this, it was planned at the time to be 2025 through 2028. And the first year of that pandemic looked exactly like what's happened over the last year with COVID. And there's a number of comparisons that you can draw between the futuristic thoughts in 2017 and the actual events 2 to 3 years later. It includes death estimates, the timing for how the outbreak was contracted, and for the development of a vaccine, the drugs that were used in the pandemic and the drugs that have been developed for the real pandemic, the power outage that we saw in Texas. Well, in this futuristic scenario, they had a very similar power outage in the Northwest of the United States. And then the vaccine propaganda SARS futuristic hypothetical pandemic produced in terms of propaganda is exactly what we saw happen here over the last 5 years. So what they did was create a prototype for all the activists to know what the game plan would be so they could think out the problem situations in advance of the real thing. And so that's what we've seen happen. And the reality of the COVID pandemic has paralleled precisely the timing, the circumstances of what was projected 2 years earlier. And it tells us that we're living in some kind of insincere world, a world where things are created and manufactured and put down our throats, and they're planned out, they're studied, they're just following their boilerplate. Mm-hmm. And the more we're aware of it, the better off we're going to be. So if somebody wants to study that more, just Google the SPARS, SPARS pandemic. And the program is a program that was anticipated to run from 2025 to 2028, which tells me that we can expect COVID to last for 3 years. And it's just that they accelerated the whole program by 5 years. It's going to run from 2020 to 2023. But the opposition to the forces of freedom are very well organized, very well financed, very well placed. And whether we're talking about politics or academia or corporate coordination, they have it all laid out. It's Goliath versus David here. Mm-hmm. And I think that we all need to get on the right team and understand what we're up against and play the role of David and win this battle of the ages.
Well, as a matter of fact, I'd love to have you explain what the world looks like at the end of this plandemic that is outlined by the SPARS document. Doesn't it get rid of the middle class, and it pretty much ends up with government in control of virtually everything?
Well, yes, and that's what we're seeing. I mean, the non-essential businesses. I mean, every business is essential to the man who or woman who
who owns
that
it.
Business.
Yeah,
but the non-essential business devastation is going to take a big hit on the middle class. And we're only 1 year into this 3-year pandemic, and there'll be more to come after that. And all of it is designed to hollow out the middle class, to defeat the force that would fight against this one world government before the one world government even comes into existence is the objective of those who are behind this scheme. And that's what we need to understand, be aware of, and fight against. And if we coordinate that fight and continue to spread the word as has been happening for two decades now, we can win. It's going to be a tough battle, but it's the battle that counts. It's the battle that history has built to this point, and the forces that would take control are forces that just need to be neutralized. And the Joe Biden dynamic is certainly part of that. Not the total effect of it, but globalist forces made a huge advance when they cheated their way into Joe Biden's becoming president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they sure did. Well, we've got a mutual friend. In fact, I believe, Michael, you're the one that introduced me to Pat Wood. And Pat Wood has been on our program a couple of times. And what we've talked about, technocracy, really what we're talking about, this brave new world that they have envisioned for us, is a technocratic state. And you mentioned transhumanism. There's a lot of things going on. This vaccine regimen that they've got in place right now includes things like DNA, RNA modifiers, hydrogel with microchips. It has artificial intelligence, things that normally would not belong in anything you would consider a vaccine to fight disease. But yet they're there, and they're there because the people intended for them to be included in this vaccine regimen. Can you talk about that at all?
Well, I'm not a vaccine expert, but clearly Pat's work on transhumanism and really the thrust of where this new world is taking us is right on point, because we do know that the vaccine does some very strange things. We do know the vaccine was man-made, at least man-altered and contoured, so that we get a vaccine that we have a disease that is never seen in history, because man's never created such a demonic concept in the past. The advances of science leave us very vulnerable, because science can be manipulated, genes now can be manipulated, and the issue with the vaccine is it does alter your gene. Mm-hmm. So is that going to change the nature of humanity? Is that the first step in transhumanism? I think that's something we need to be concerned with. It's why many of us don't get the vaccine, even though there may be social consequences to us in so doing. We may not be able to fly on airplanes, et cetera, as the squeeze gets tightened on people in order to get the vaccine. But this is a grand experiment, a grand experiment that I don't want to be a part of, because the whole idea is to change the nature of humanity, is to reduce our numbers, and for those that survive, to make them a new being, this transhumanist being, of which I would be very suspect that this vaccine is the first step in creating a transhumanist for all future activity. And, and as you said earlier, all of this begins to suggest, if this road goes too far, we end up at an end time scenario, because I can't imagine that the forces of good and that God himself is going to allow his creation to be manipulated by mad scientists who have to be promoted, nourished by the devil himself, to come up with such dastardly concepts that we're now seeing happen all around the world. And this is why we need to step back, understand what we face, and seek the Almighty's assistance in the biggest battle humanity has ever seen.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And we are, well, when this pandemic thing first came out, we are seeing Agenda 21 being fully implemented. Because you think about it, Michael, this vaccine regimen, you can't travel unless you get the vaccine, right? You're supposed to stay away from people. You're supposed to stay 6 feet away. You wear the mask so that you're not communicating with people. You're told that you can't even participate in family events like Christmas or Thanksgiving because of the so-called pandemic. And all these things are really inherently part of UN Agenda 21, because the whole thing, it mirrors what they're trying to do. Eliminate travel, eliminate personal travel, eliminate private property, eliminate the middle class, eliminate cars and vehicles, make everybody take public transportation, and then make sure that when they take that public transportation, that they control the access to it. I mean, this whole thing, you couldn't make this stuff up. This whole thing is right out of UN Agenda 21.
Well, I think that's right. And the more people understand that, the better we'll be in terms of being able to engage in this fight and not be defeated in it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I appreciate you coming and talking to our listeners, but I want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about Freedom Advocates, your group in California, some of the programs that you've worked on. I've got a number of your publications and DVDs and information on Freedom Force. Tell our listeners a little bit about your group and what you're trying to accomplish with Freedom Force. Freedom Advocates.
Freedom Advocates we formed in the around 2000. And we were very active that decade and for the first years of the next decade. And it's just a good source for basic and original information on Agenda 21 and how it spreads and what it stands for. And we have all kinds of information from writings to video talks to presentations, et cetera. And it's a good way for someone to brush up on the history and nature of Agenda 21. And I would encourage people to look at it because it's rather timeless material. I look at things that we did in 2005 and they're just as true today as they were then. So it's something that to engage in the fight today, to become aware of the SARS pandemic and understand what we're really facing with COVID dynamic, is to understand the origins and the foundations of Agenda 21, because you can't fight what you don't know. And our purpose with Freedom Advocates was to make sure that people understood the nature of Agenda 21.
Well, I know when I first met you, and that was back, I'm thinking it was around 2008, or 2009, you were doing a speaking tour of Montana. And I traveled with you around the state as you went around the state talking to different groups. You were doing that around the country. You and certainly Patrick Wood, Debbie Boscalupi, Rosa Corey, a number of people have done this kind of work. You did an event at, I believe, Treasure Island, where you did a whole weekend there talking about UN Agenda 21 and did a video of that. People are finally starting to wake up. I know in Montana, when I started talking UN Agenda 21 back around the time that I met you, people look at you like you had three eyeballs when you start talking about this stuff. But I ended up doing a program for the breakfast for the Montana Republican State Convention with a good friend of mine who was the head of the Pachyderm Club at the time. He asked me to be a speaker at their breakfast event. And I gave him the Agenda 21 program in 30 minutes. And I have to tell you, there wasn't a dry seat in the place when we got done. People just freaked when they saw all the information. And I said, check it out for yourself. Everything I've got here is documented. Check it out for yourself. And since then, I think the whole state of Montana now, I'll bet you 75% of the state now knows about Agenda 21 and knows that it's a real problem. Work like what you've done has been absolutely critical in the expose of UN Agenda 21, 2030. And we need to keep this pressure on, don't we?
Well, we do. We do. I don't think there's a more important human fight. And this is one that has to be won, or all things that Americans consider valuable will be gone. Mm-hmm. And you're right about the progress that's been made over the last 15 years. It's remarkable. I think it is credible to the election of Donald Trump 5 years ago. And we just need to restore the progress that had been made and that continues to be made in some respects, and make sure that we don't put globalists in charge of the American government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've got one there now. And
I think we have more than one.
Well, we do. We've got a lot of them there.
One of them's from California, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I won't tell you what Edwin Vieira refers to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, but it's pretty funny. anyway, we really need to understand that we are right now in the most critical fight for the history of this, in the history of this country. And we're talking even since the Revolutionary War. I'm talking, maybe the Revolutionary War wasn't as critical as the battle we're in against the forces of evil now. And you're right, it's a biblical fight, because at the point we're at right now, they plan to eliminate such a huge percentage of the human population off the face of the earth. There's never been a plan like that in the history of the world, ever.
Well, that's right. And that's why we have to take what we're facing seriously, because this is the fight of all time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've got to remember that America is the first place that recognized equal rights. We're not talking about equity now. We're talking about equal rights. Every man has the same rights as the next man, whether you're president of the United States or whether you or me. We all have the rights that are articulated in our Constitution, that are based in our society. And amongst those is the right to private property. In fact, without private property ideas, you become private property. And that's what the communists did. That's what the totalitarians do, and that's what we're facing today. The right to private property is the right to individualism. It's the right to be who you are. It's being protected with the idea of equal rights, not the idea of social equity, which is really a communist idea and the idea that's coming to the fore today. And so we've got a lot to defend. We've got a lot to fight for, and we need to just get more and more serious in our endeavor in doing that.
Well, you wrote an article a while back for Freedom Advocates, and then I took that article and we visited about it. And I tried to get it published in Forest Stewardship Journal. Naturally, having a government employee as the head of the group, it got nixed. But the fact is, private property is the human. The human, our own bodies are our private property. That's right. Why
that's where private property starts.
Yeah, we should have the right, whether or not we want to take this vaccine, we should have the right to say no. We should have the right to say, I believe what I want to believe, and you cannot force me to believe something I don't. We should have the right to think. I mean, you know, they talk free speech zones and all this other crazy nonsense that's going on in our university system. It's all based on the idea that we really need to eliminate the ability for human beings to be able to make their own choices. And that is what they're trying to do with UN Agenda 21. That's what they're trying to do with all the things that they're doing right now. Political correctness, the Black Lives Matter movement, the Antifa movement. All this is based on silencing individuals, making their own choices and being able to decide what's right for them. This is all what's part of this pattern, and that's why it's so dangerous, because if they accomplish this, they will have taken away every right we have.
Well, that seems to be the process we're being subjected to.
Yeah, it does. Well, Dr. Shiva is running a little late this morning, so if you don't mind, Michael, I'd like to keep you on until Shiva shows up, and then we will see what he has to say about the whole idea of the Paris Accords, because he's done the economic policies on that. And it looks like Dr. Shiva has determined, as you and I have, this isn't about the environment. This is about changing, transferring wealth from the United States. This is about changing the dynamic of private property. This is about making changes, fundamental transformation of America from a system based on freedom and free choice and free thought and private property into a system that's totally controlled by the left. And one of the things that Paris Accords, and as soon as we get Dr. Shiva on, we can look at the actual numbers, but they're talking about the United States deindustrializing and then turning all this wealth over to so-called developing countries like Red China, who now has the biggest industrial economy in the world, and in real terms has the biggest economy in the world, and yet they're given a free pass. These communist countries are given a free pass while the United States is being destroyed from within. Isn't that amazing how they've done that?
Well, it's totally amazing. I mean, I had thought the Paris Accord was something that had faded away. And Joe Biden gets elected, and within a day, it's back on the table. And we play a very subservient role to the role that China assumes in this, as China is now locked into a position where they can have economic advances without any environmental limitations, whereas the United States and the rest of the world is subject to massive environmental limitations, totally choking any economic progress we can make. And so it's a total misfit for the world, and a total benefit to China. And one has to wonder if Joe Biden's Chinese connection, or the Biden family's Chinese connection, $1.5 billion that China has loaned the Biden family on a forgivable basis. All the Bidens have to do is what it is that China wants them to do in order for that loan of $1.5 billion to be forgiven by China to the Bidens. I mean, it makes Benedict Arnold look like a good guy when you compare the Biden family's activities with China. to what Benedict Arnold did with England. So we're in a dangerous position from so many perspectives. And, you know, this administration in D.C. today, the stolen administration, I call it, got into office under some pretty shady circumstances. It's a price that all of us are paying now, and we're going to pay for the next three and a half years. And it's time to be very concerned.
Yes, it is. We're literally at the point right now where if we don't stop this slide into the progressive transformation of America, we will be living under global communism, and there won't be any other alternatives. People around the world are looking to the United States for leadership in fighting off this transformation to a world communist system. They're looking for us to provide that leadership. And quite honestly, I talk to people all over the world who are saying to me, Dan, what's the matter with the United States? Why aren't you people doing more to protect yourselves and to protect the world so that freedom can reign around the world? And you can't answer it, because in truth, there's no excuse for Americans to just say, well, you know, it's not our problem. It is our problem. We are the ones that are going to have to fight this. We're the ones that are going to have to make a difference.
Well, that's right. And it's time for the good to get going.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got to be ready. People say, well, what can I do? Well, the first thing you can do is get off your damn couch and start going to some of these planning commission meetings, go to some of these school board meetings, go to some of these county commission meetings, go to some of these city council meetings. Be part of the people who present an alternative to this lockstep into the New World Order.
Well, people need to understand that all those organizations you referenced have been affected by Agenda 21. They are the ones implementing Agenda 21. Agenda 21 is known as local Agenda 21. It has invaded every city, every county, and the people who get the jobs, the people who are working for government, are people who have been indoctrinated and educated in the program of Agenda 21, how to implement it, how to move it forward. And then the perfect example of that is this SARS production out of John Hopkins University, where the bureaucrats learn the system so that the citizens can be just trampled over. And the only way to avoid that is for the citizens to show up and to get increasingly organized, increasingly articulate. And I'm seeing that happen in places all over. And that needs to continue and to grow, because if you want America to survive, you need to get in the battle.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We are at a critical point in the life of this country. And Michael, you know, I was a county commissioner. And anybody who does their job had better plan on being a one-term person in that political role. And that's fine. That's the way the founders envisioned it. We were to be citizen legislators. We weren't intended to be full-time professional legislators. I have friends who ran for the state legislature in Montana, and they were only there one or two terms because the forces behind the transfer to Agenda 21 have unlimited amount of money that they'll throw in races to support candidates that are promoting their agenda. and defeating the people who are against their agenda. That's just the way it is, Michael. We need to understand that's just the way it is. So, you know, people need to wake up to the reality that if you do run, you're not going to be there for a long period of time. So do it. Get off your butt and be part of the solution, because you can make a difference.
Well, that's right. And that's why, you know, if you don't make a difference, if collectively we don't make a difference, the abyss that we are sliding into is going to be an abyss that nobody is going to be happy with.
Because, no, that's right.
Firstly, our prospects for survival are low, because the plan is not many of us will survive. And, you know, that may be the bottom line, but in between, there'll be all kinds of things that none of us are going to be confident or comfortable with, because it's an ugly world that's being planned by those who are taking controls and are changing our systems, who are just destroying our systems. And these are the things that we need to educate ourselves on so that we can move forward.
Michael, if you wouldn't mind, please go ahead and take that thought a little further. I believe Dr. Shiv is trying to get a hold of me on my phone.
Sure. Well, I think it's really very important that we, as individuals, become committed to the survival of the country, meaning that we're going to take the action that needs to be taken in order to stymie and ultimately stall out this globalist drive to a world order where we are but cogs in their machine, and where they intend to transform the nature of humanity into automated, controlled person. All people in that context, all surviving people in that context. And that's a dynamic that we cannot endure, because it goes to our essence. There's nothing great about becoming transhuman, that is part machine and part human nature. It may be that your muscles get bigger and your intellect gets sharper, but this is not the way we really progress in a life that has eternity behind our lives, and that leaves us in a very compromised condition.
Well, Michael, I know that you are a big appreciator of private property. That's been, you're a developer. You've done this for literally decades, know the whole program. And the thing is, if they take away the ability of private property and the ability for people to, to develop, to do things, we're taking away a huge part of what makes this country successful, aren't we?
Well, we are, and we should not take that lightly, because that's a very disconcerting objective that globalists have, and one that we have to, you know, fight tooth and nail and preserve our nature as God subjects, human beings who are pursuing the best we can with faults and all, not subjecting ourselves to globalist control and technocratic makeovers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now we Agenda 21, everything leads to Agenda 21, 2030. And we've had Debbie Boscalupi and Rosa Corey and yourself and a number of others on to talk about it. I'm going to mention this Paris Accord because it was a big deal. In the Paris Accords, they are talking about fully implementing a carbon credit system. Now, in the mid-90s, the Clinton family and Al Gore, at the behest of the Joyce Foundation, who were the funders, and incidentally, the Joyce Foundation at the time their legal counselor and one of their head directors was Barack Hussein Obama, developed a group called the Shore Bank out of Chicago. And this Shore Bank was created to put together a whole program on the carbon credit banking system. I happened to do an interview with one of the guys that actually was one of the mentors behind this whole program. His name is Ted Dodge. He was from Montana. And what they were doing is putting together a program where carbon would be taxed and you could trade carbon, which was worth money, that was taxed from industry. And then that carbon could be paid in the form of cash payments to farmers and others who were able to mitigate carbon. The whole program was just ridiculously political. And the Bidens, the Clintons, the Gores, apparently the Obamas and others were directors in the Shore Bank and were planning to profit largely from the sale of carbon credits. That's back on the table because that was part of what the Paris Accords are all about, is creating a carbon credit system again and taxing industry that produces carbon dioxide. And in turn, then rewarding people for mitigating carbon, so bearing carbon or doing whatever they want to do. Well, carbon makes up everything. Every physical thing we see on Earth is made out of carbon. Human bodies are carbon. I mean, the sidewalks are carbon. Everything is carbon. How in the world can they come up with a plan like this? It's like the old Uncle Remus and the Tar Baby story, where the more you punch the damn thing, the worse you get stuck. Yeah. And that's exactly what they're doing with this program.
Well, you know, it's been since 1988 they've been talking about global warming. And I remember as a teenager, that was a long time ago, it was a lot hotter than it is today. And I don't see any warming in the last 25 years. And yet they keep saying that in the next 8 years is going to be massive amounts of warming. How many 8-year periods do you need to go through that where there is no warming and have 8 years later them pronounce even to greater extents that warming is going to happen? I think that's a scheme that American people are over. Joe Biden is beginning to talk about it again now that Barack Obama has been out of office for 4 years. It's right back on the center plate. And I just don't understand how anybody can buy off on that, because it's been this false promise of Armageddon that's been going on for decades, and it hasn't happened. It's not getting warmer, despite all their weather modification activities. They're playing with danger in that context. And they're chasing a ghost that doesn't exist. And we just can't be duped by it anymore, because the price of following their directives on this matter are just becoming too high. And the politicians who keep talking about this are politicians that need to be abandoned, because there are bigger and better things for the American public to be concerned with and to get on the bandwagon for. Global warming is not one of those dynamics. And the Paris climate agreements are nothing but more hogwash about global warming and its effects. And gee whiz, there hasn't been global warming. There are no effects. Let's stop talking about it.
Well, as a matter of fact, I remember that John Holdren and others in the 1970s were talking about the world slipping into another ice age. And in fact, now we're in a moderate minimum, which is a reduced solar activity time when we're going to see a cooler climate. Well, you know, when Al Gore's complete melting of the polar ice cap didn't happen in 2008 like he said it was going to, and they actually had the second most polar ice in something like 100 years, then all of a sudden they start calling it climate change. Climate is always changing. Oh,
every day.
The sun controls virtually all the climate. Solar activity controls virtually all the climate because it controls tidal systems. The moon is part of that process, but our climate is constantly changing. And so to call it climate change rather than global warming is a great way to create a scenario where no matter what, they've got something to bellyache about.
Well, that's right. But that bellyaching is like a child who complains incessantly after they've recovered from their illness. You know, that's what the global warmers are like. I mean, it gets tiresome after a while. I'm tired of it. And there are better things, bigger things for us as individuals and as a society need to address. And there are real problems, and they need attention.
Yeah, well, on things like the BLM, the rioting in the cities, I fully agree that Black Lives Matter, but it's just too bad that the group representing Black Lives happens to be a Marxist communist group, and they openly admit they don't care. I mean, they go into a city like Seattle and Portland. Who are the businesses they burn down? They're the Black businesses in the inner city area. I mean, how in the world can these people claim to be concerned about Black lives when they're also the same people who promote abortion? 40% of the abortions performed in the United States in the last 50 years since Roe v. Wade, 40% of all those abortions are on Black people, when they only represent 13% of the population. I mean, this is genocide, and it's against the very people that they claim they're trying to help. Now, if we want to see slavery and they want to return to slavery, all we've got to do is fully implement all these crazy programs that they've got under UN Agenda 21 and all these different things that they're trying to promote, because what we're seeing right now is what I would call a future vision of what a slave state really looks like.
Well, you're right about that. And I think so much of the Black community is aware of that. I think it's a minority influence that that BLM represents. Mm-hmm. And yet they get such support from press and leftist organizations. You can't call them liberal anymore. They're not liberal. They're just left. And, that means that they want to take control over you. And most Black people don't want to have control taken over them, just as white people don't want control taken over them. We need to organize and continue to fight back and stop this assault of Agenda 21. And what follows from it, which includes the whole pandemic operation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I see Dr. Shiva's trying to get Michael, I appreciate your staying with us on this thing. I see that Dr. Shiva is trying to get connected. He's having trouble with the password for some reason. But anyway, I'd love to have you stay on. I'd love to have you kind of hear what Dr. Shiva's got to talk about. There he is. Dr. Shiva, welcome to the show. You are muted right now, but please unmute. And I look forward to hearing you talk about What's wrong with the Paris Accords?
Yeah, Dan, I apologize. It kept asking for a password, so I wasn't sure what's going on. So how are you doing?
Good, good. Well, keep those passwords, because every time you join us on Patriot Soapbox, it's always the same one.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, where would you like me to start?
Well, we're doing a program. Michael Shaw, incidentally, who is a good friend of mine from California, he's an attorney, a CPA, has been involved in the One Bay Area plan for a long time. We've been talking about UN Agenda 21-2030 and how that's really the root of what is called the Paris Climate Accord. I'm introducing you to Michael Shaw. This is Dr. Shiva. Dr. Shiva, you've done an extensive analysis of what the costs to the United States of America would be by fully implementing the Paris Climate Accords, and why Donald Trump was correct in getting us out. Please talk about that.
Well, I think, Dan, hopefully you can hear me all right. I think the first thing to understand is the broader nature of climate systems. I'm a systems guy, and I have a bunch of degrees from MIT in engineering systems. And one of the things you understand is engineering systems problems are very, very difficult to solve, especially when you're dealing with what are called complex systems. So if you look at the climate as, frankly, a complex system, and in fact, it's very important to understand this if you just step back, you have two turbulent fluids that are interacting together. One is the ocean, which is moving at a certain time scale of, years, decades, meaning changes that take place, millennia sometimes, right? So it's a very long time scale, as we say in systems theory. The other time scale that you have, the other fluid that you have, is called the atmosphere. All right, so you have these very two complex fluids, turbulent fluids. And by the way, you can win $1 million, a millennial award, I think it's called, if you solve the Navier-Stokes equations for just a turbulent fluid. It's an unsolved problem, all right? So when you look at the climate system, it's a very, very complex system. And look, I've been dealing with complex modeling most of my life, back from modeling sleep systems when I was a 14-year-old kid, my master's work looking at computational waves and different kinds of media. It's what I do for a living. But just modeling one turbulent fluid is known as an impossible problem today. So when you look at something as complex as the climate, you have two turbulent fluids which are interacting. And why is this important? Well, if you think about the Earth here and the sun here, the sun is around 5,000 degrees Kelvin, and it radiates, right? It's sending out radiation, which hits the Earth, about 340 watts per meter, okay? Tremendous amount of energy. 100 of that bounces off the Earth's atmosphere, so then 140 of that, which means the Earth is getting 200 watts per meter coming in, right? So in order, basic accounting, it's got to get rid of that. Otherwise, the Earth is going to burn up. Right? So what does it do to get rid of that radiation? Well, think about the Earth, the surface of the Earth, having a certain temperature, no different than a frying pan that you would put on, on your stove, and you put water on it. What happens when the water boils? It goes off, right? Mm-hmm. Through convection. So what the Earth tries to do, the Earth has a certain temperature, which people said was around 15 degrees. All right. And that temperature is enough to make sure that convection occurs and you balance that energy. All right. So it's a very complex problem. That's the bottom line. So I think Jim Hansen, the guy at NASA, I think before 2000 or before 1997, they had said that the average surface temperature of the Earth was 15 degrees. Well, around late 90s, early 2000, the temperature of the Earth was not, in fact, the temperature of the Earth was going down. So in a footnote, I believe, to a New York Times article, they changed, overnight, they changed the average surface temperature of the Earth to 14 degrees. So 14 became the new 15. There's an article written by Arvind Kumar, and he brings this up, all right? So that's what happened. So the entire basis of all of this is, why is this going on, right? And more importantly, what we've done is we've taken a very complex system and we've reduced it. The key word is the word reduce, called reductionism, to one variable. We call it carbon, CO2. And by the way, this is what's happening with the sciences all around the world. We take a very complex system like the immune system and we reduce it to one variable, antibodies. So if you have X amount of antibodies, you're fine, you're in good shape. So this is what happens with fake science today, unfortunately. Fake science meaning the science of reductionism. You take a very complex system, you just take one little piece of it, and then you say, oh, that is a measure of success or failure, which is CO2. Okay? So that's what they've done. So you take this on a model that's very, very hard to compute, first of all. Now, if you look at this model, this very complex model, why would you do this, right? What's the intention of doing this, right? And you find out that when you look at and you step back a little bit and you understand that the basis of the climate, quote unquote, change concept goes all the way back, I think, to the 1980s, right? When Al Gore wrote his book, right? And he was actually blaming Nazism or something. He was blaming something else for climate change, okay? Anything you could grapple on, you know, because everything is a couple of degrees of freedom away. So what you have is you have the intention of choosing a single variable to model this very complex phenomenon. Now, if you look at the climate change models that the IPCC put out, even in 2018, right, when the last one came out, the report, and you actually read it, if you actually go spend time reading it, you'll find out that when you look at their model's prediction of ice melting in the Arctic, there's not just one prediction, there's 21 predictions. Now, in science, what is evidence? Evidence is unambiguous predictions. I'll repeat that. For a scientist in the field I'm in modeling and computational modeling, it's unambiguous predictions. If your model unambiguously predicts the answer, that's called evidence, okay? Otherwise, your model is just garbage. But if you look at the models that they have in the IPCC report, there's actually not just one prediction of climate change, there's 21. And if you look, you would think they would be all be nearby, right? Okay, I don't know, 20% are going to melt or 30%. There are like the Baskin-Robbins ice cream flavor. There's 21 different predictions. One says all of the ice caps are going to melt 100%. Another one says none will melt. And there's variations all the way between. So, you know, it's basically they threw a bunch of darts at a dartboard and they got a bunch of answers. That is not called science. That's called indeterminacy. This would be no different than if you took Newton's model of you know, an apple falling from a tree. Let's imagine one model predicts that it'll hit the ground. Another model predicts it'll hang 2 feet above the ground. Another model predicts 4 feet. Another model predicts it won't even fall, right? You have many, many different predictions. That is not a model. That's not science. And this is in the IPCC report. And most scientists in academia know this is garbage, but they won't say anything. And that gets into the economics of this. The economics is starting in 1971 with the passage of the Mansfield Amendment or the late, early 70s. Science became highly politicized because prior to that, there was a little bit of fun. If you looked at the entire military budget, which is massive, there was a little sliver of it for basic research. Well, that sliver was a lot of money still because the military budget was so big. And that sliver was given to do some, I mean, it's a sort of an irony that the military had this basic research budget, but they gave it freely to do all sorts of basic research to the best guys in the world. And they weren't under any thumb to, you know, file grants, et cetera. But after the Vietnam War, that little sliver, they said, the military should not be funding any basic research, only if it was for weapons. So that little budget went under two major organizations, the NSF, okay, and the NIH, parts of it. So which meant that science became, and those two are highly political organizations, highly, highly political. So it's no longer, you know, you had this great, you know, remember prior to the 1950s, 40s, there was all sorts of contests. People would do wild research. Mm-hmm. But starting in 1970, science became highly consolidated. It became really an industry. People like Eisenhower saw this coming. You know, that's why he called it the military-industrial complex. In fact, his original speech said military-industrial academic complex. Jay Stratton, who was a science advisor president of MIT, removed the word academic. For, you know,
oh, really?
Hmm. Yeah. The person who used military-industrial academic complex was William Fulbright. in a speech that he gave in 1971 or something like this. Okay. But the fundamental issue here is that the science became highly, highly politicized. The NIH became highly politicized, biological sciences, all of these sciences became very politicized. So at MIT gets around $20 to $40 million for climate change research. So anything you put, so if you're a young academic and you need money to get, you have 7 years, by the way, to get tenure, right? Let's say you join as a newly minted PhD at MIT or Harvard or any of these big institutions. You have 7 years to publish your papers, you know, get good citations and get tenure, which means you have a job for life. So how do you get tenure? Well, you have to, first of all, bring in money so you can fund graduate students to do your research, right? You're running a little cottage industry there. Well, how do you get grants? Well, you have to sniff out money and you have to figure out where it's coming from. So today, the science, by and large, has become highly mediocre. You get rid of all the really radical thinking guys because they're probably going to think radically around politics too, right? They're just not in science. And you bring in mediocre people who are chasing the almighty dollar. So now, you in the biological sciences, you have Fauci and Francis Collins who control the NIH fund flow. That's why you have a very restrictive thinking around any type of things around immunity or immunology. And same thing with this area of climate change. So follow the money. I keep saying everyone should just follow the money. The money in science dictates policy, so you get results that you want. So they have taken this very complex thing called the climate and said, let's reduce this one little variable called CO2, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And based on the reduction of that, we're going to solve the world's problems, all problems. So this is the same thing they've done with the current issue with the immune system. Antibodies, antibodies, antibodies. Forget everything else, right? So this is called reductionism. So who does that serve? Well, if you step back, I did a video, I think a couple of years ago, which went viral. I think it's got probably like 30, 40 million views on it now, where I literally in 17 minutes, I explained the entire climate change industry. And I basically took it from left to right, if you see it on the board. And I said, okay, here's what's going on today. You're a business and you run a company or you run some business. You're polluting something. Everyone's polluting some amount of pollution, right? Well, what happens today? You spend a certain amount of money for running your business. You're polluting something. You charge certain for your products and people pay you money, right? That's today. Now in 2030, what happens? Well, you're still running your business. You're polluting something. And you have to, you're producing products, but this time in 2030, there's going to be something a little bit different. In 2030, what happens is when you pollute, okay, you have until 2030 to keep polluting. But after 2030, you're going to buy what's called carbon credits to offset your pollution. And that purchase of those carbon credits, which will be cost to you because there's a limited number of carbon credits, right? And so what are carbon credits? Carbon credits basically says, we're going to allow you to pollute, but in order to offset your pollution, you're going to have to buy credits from people who are non-polluting, right, to offset your pollution. So in 2018, at that time, before Trump pulled out, 2017, China, by way of example, was polluting 11 billion metric tons of carbon, 11 billion metric tons mm-hmm. of carbon. I think India around 2 billion. Okay. By 2030, and everyone should listen to this very carefully, the Paris Accords allows China to double their pollution. Let me repeat that. The Paris Accords allows China to go from 11 billion metric tons of carbon to 22 billion metric tons of carbon up until 2030. The number one cause of death globally is lung disease, COPD. Number one cause. So China is allowed to double. They already have bad smog in China. They're allowed to double it.
Mm-hmm.
After 2030, China will have to buy these carbon credits. Okay. Now, in 2017, when Trump pulled out of the Accords, the Democrats and Republicans were getting ready to fund what was called a Green Fund, a $100 billion Green Fund. Sounds like a great name, Green Fund. Okay. What was that for? Well, the Green Fund, if you actually explore it, was going to be given to all of these countries. And if you actually follow it, it was basically a corruption fund. that money was going to be given to consultants and the health minister or the environmental ministers in every all these countries, because a lot of these countries did not want to join the Paris Accords. If you go, they were unwilling to join. They're like, wait a minute, we're going to have to pay all this money. We're going to have to buy carbon tax credits. They didn't want to do it. So you look at Jairam Ramesh, who was the, you know, the one of the ministers in India. He, at that point, was saying, oh, everything's fine with the Himalayas. Nothing is, there's no ice, you know, caps melting. And what came out in WikiLeaks was that he was actually very thankful to John Podesta for the Green Fund, because then suddenly he changes his tune and he says, oh my God, the ice caps are melting on the Himalayas. So all of these ministers and consultants in all these countries, that Green Fund was going to be a corruption scheme. They would get paid. You know how this works, right? They give money to and somehow their job was to convince the prime ministers of their countries, yes, we must enter the Paris Accords. And that's what that money was for. And that's what Trump got the United States out of. He cut the ties to that Green Fund. But starting in 2030, what's going to happen? Well, there's a limited set of carbon credits, which are, you know, exchange, right, on the commodities market. I believe, and we should verify this, this was many years ago, Al Gore was on the board of the company, one of the one or two companies which owns a software to track all the carbon credits. And they take a little piece of it. They get a licensing fee. And at one point, I think Gore actually owned a lot of the carbon credits. So now if you think about it, that if you have a limited number of carbon credits and you're going to have to buy carbon credits to offset your pollution, what's going to happen to the price of an individual carbon credit? It's going to explode in price. So those people who own those carbon credits are going to become trillionaires. So,
Shiva, I want to mention to you, I just know a little bit about this. Shore Bank was created with funding from the Joyce Foundation, which Obama was actually the head director of the Joyce Foundation at the time. They created an organization called Shore Bank that was it was created to trade in carbon credits. I knew one of the guys that helped Gore come up with this carbon credit plan. His name was Ted Dodge. He actually came up with part of the plan that he gave to Gore. The Clintons and the Gores and the I believe that Biden was connected to it as well as the Obamas were all part of this Shore Bank organization that was put together just to trade carbon credits.
Yeah, and I think people should just understand something very, very simple. If you look at a lot of the elites, they're all buying homes on beautiful seashore property, right? Right on the shores. Obama just bought, I believe, a $15 million home in Martha's Vineyard. This is just a month ago. I mean, a couple of months ago. So if they are so concerned about, you know, the water is rising and the ice caps melting, why would you go buy property, you know, inches or feet from the ocean?
Right.
So right. I think what needs to happen, Dan, is my view is if we take a systems approach, which is what I teach people, you know, we just had a big class yesterday, about 100 people on. The only way forward is people not to get involved in these wacky conspiracy theories, but take a systems approach and directly connect it to economics. So when you really step back and look at it, the economics of this is quite simple. You need academia to write stuff, okay? And that quote unquote science is then regurgitated by the mainstream media, who basically most of these guys don't even do any research anymore. And then it becomes fossilized on Wikipedia, because Wikipedia is all about citations. Remember, Wikipedia says they're not about truth. You can say Dan beats his dog, and I could write an article over here that says Dan beats his dog, and Wikipedia can reference that and says, yes, Dan beats his dog, when that article may have been completely bogus. So what they've done is a racketeering that's done, it's almost a RICO enterprise, is that you pay academics, you incent them to take a reductionist view of some topic like climate change. They write papers because they're getting funded. They get their tenure on that issue. Journalists then simply do the self-referral. So that shows up in a popular article. And then Wikipedia says, yes, this is happening. So this is the media dynamics. I wrote a white paper on this many years ago because it occurred to me with the invention of email, you know. The facts are I invented email as a 14-year-old kid. It was done before I came to MIT, when I converted the old-fashioned inter-office mail system, named it email, have the first copyright, never spoke about it, Dan. The day it went into the Smithsonian in 2011, Time Magazine wrote a beautiful article saying the man who invented email, my mom had died, all the artifacts went into the Smithsonian. And on February 16, 2012, a Washington Post reporter wrote a very glowing article saying Shiva Agrey honored as the inventor of email. Well, that's what triggered all of these liberal elites who had written the false narrative of email, that it came out of the military doing simple text messaging. That's not email. But the problem was that I had all the data and all the facts. Wikipedia just kept referring to them and still does. Mm-hmm. So the issue with the invention of email, what's related to this is, from a scientific, from an innovation standpoint, email was not invented at MIT. It wasn't invented at Silicon Valley. It was invented by a 14-year-old kid in Newark, New Jersey, where nothing is supposed to come out of. You see, so the entire goal here is to centralize innovation, centralize science. And that is a weapon, centralization, that people in power can use so they can call upon their favors as they need to get the science they need. That's the inconvenient truth. Mm-hmm. The inconvenient truth is they make it very convenient to get the truth that you need. You know?
It's amazing. Anybody that doesn't believe what Dr. Shiva is saying, please read Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. The scientific community in there did exactly that. This is happening. It's been happening for a long time. You're 100% spot on with saying that it's all about the money. Just follow the money.
Yeah, Dan, I mean, when I look back at the invention of email story, a friend of mine who used to run Business Insider, Kevin Ryan, he said, Shiva, he's a publisher, but he goes, Shiva, the story of the invention of email, there's no doubt you created email. You wrote all the code. It's here. You named it email, and you have the copyright at a time when copyright was the only, the real question is, why was there even a controversy? And this is the heart of the issue. The reason they created a controversy was because if email got created in Newark, New Jersey, if TV got created by Philo Farnsworth in Franklin, Idaho, if it was a Michigan mechanic who created control systems theory, which he did, right? Not MIT. This basically removes a very powerful lever that elites have to control science and innovation. This is what they fear, because the truth is innovation and science is in everyone's DNA. It can occur anytime, any place, by anybody. And so therefore they have to restrict science and innovation. That's why they put so much effort into creating brands, right? Like MIT, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, et cetera. And the problem they have with someone like me is I got all their training, but I have the experience to know that I didn't need to go to MIT to invent anything. I was capable of doing that even before I came. And that is true with science also. So that's why I think, you know, we've talked about the issue here. It's a problem here is when you look at the climate issue, it is a one instance. And I think this is where people need to learn. This occurs in every field. It's a very powerful way to understand that you can take a very complex scientific system. You can pass that scientific system on to experts who can now falsely localize a problem to one variable called reductionism, not a systems approach, and then get the answer that they need. In 1962, John Kennedy gave a very famous speech, and not a very famous speech, it was a speech, sorry, it was probably a speech that should have been famous, to the National Academy of Sciences. I came across this about a couple of years ago. And it's interesting, he's saying, you know, here is where we have the conundrum in democracy right now. And the conundrum we have is that, you know, millions of people, I mean, I'm paraphrasing what he said, elected leaders. Most elected leaders are not scientists, they're not engineers, they can't even think pretty much about anything because they're typically lawyers, right? Or somebody, right, who just got money to get elected or manipulated the election system. When they get into office, and Kennedy was being in some ways much more honest, and he was giving this speech to 2,500 scientists at the National Academy of Sciences, he goes, the conundrum is, I rely on you now, a small set of people, not 50 million people elected him, but 2,500 people, or even less, five people, five university presidents, to tell him what to do on a complex system, climate, weapon systems, transportation, because these systems have become so complex. So we take a lot of complexity and we go to two people who decide public policy for the rest of 50 million, 100 million, 200 a billion people. That's what's happening. Mm-hmm. So this is what the decision-making of the trajectory of society is not being determined by the public. It's being determined by two or three people, literally, who advise a Senate judiciary panel or a, you know, Senate subcommittee or House subcommittee what to do. And where are they getting their information from, right? Well, and what is the motivation for their ideas, right? Mm-hmm. And what Kennedy was saying, this is a conundrum we have with democracy. The only way out of this, Dan, is the solution that I've come up with all humility, which is we need to train the broad mass of people on a systems approach to science. And so, you know, every Mondays, when I looked at, you know, growing up in India, my grandmother practiced a traditional system of medicine known as Siddha, completely different system. She could look at your face, she could predict your particular constitution, then she'd figure out what was right for you. Now, the average Westerner looking at this saying, this is garbage, it's snake oil. So my journey, and I also grew up in a caste system where we were considered low caste untouchables, right? So I was very interested in systems. So my journey to the United States as a 7-year-old kid was to understand complex systems in and out of MIT. And it was only in 2003 when I came back to medicine because there was a field called systems biology that got created. Why? Ironically, because the old model of understanding biology was this reductionist model, which was just looking at the parts of something. They said, oh, human beings and are more complex because we must have more genes. A worm had 20,000. When the Genome Project ended, it turned out we only have 20,000 genes. That flipped biology on its head because a reductionist approach to biology was proven to be false. You can't look at a system based on the number of items it has. You have to look at the interconnections. How does the ocean react with the atmosphere? How do the clouds react with all that? I mean, it gets quite complex. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So instead of taking that systems approach, you take one variable. That's what happened in biology. So I came back in 2003, spent 5 years creating a technology called Cytosol where we could model complex biological phenomena on the computer using a systems approach. That led me back to India. What I discovered was the Indian system of medicine was not a system of medicine. It was actually an engineering system of principles that matched one-to-one with the principles of engineering systems theory that was created in the 1930s. So what I've started doing is to educate. I can educate any layman. You don't have to have any degrees. You can be like my grandmother, or you can be a school teacher. You can be a PhD at MIT. And I've started educating people in 3 hours to understand the systems approach. And they can use these fundamental, it's a technology, it's a science. They can use it to understand their body as a system. They can use it to understand climate as a system. They can use it to understand their computer as a system. They can use it to understand electronic voting machines as a system. They can use it to understand the political system as a system. And that is a foundational knowledge. And with that knowledge, they can now understand three principles. One is that we need to build a bottoms-up movement. Forget Republicans, forget Democrats, forget left, forget right, forget Trump, forget Bernie, forget all these guys. The history of human activity and change has always come from working people building a bottoms-up movement, bottoms-up. And whenever you suppress that bottoms-up nature, people decentrally build something, that's the way you have power. And that's what's happened in academia. We've centralized things. Second thing is the establishment is very, very, very clever at creating the not-so-obvious version of itself. No different than the Pharisees were to the Sadducees, okay? Like, they would talk on this, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That they're very clever, always creating people who talk a good game. This happens in every field. But the reality is they don't go at the heart of the real systems issue. They just talk around the issue and never act. But most importantly, the interrelation between freedom, why we must have freedom, because freedom is the raw material which allows us to do real science. And when you suppress freedom, you have censorship. You don't do science. You don't practice a scientific method. You practice scientific consensus. Mm-hmm. So what do they say? Yes, there is a consensus now that the oceans are rising. It's not true. There's mm-hmm. a consensus the oceans are getting more acidic. I was in Andover, Massachusetts, a very elite community, in a library. 150 people had come. They had invited a professor from BU to give a talk on climate change. And these are all your highly educated liberal elites, what I call the vulnerable, uneducated elites. Mm-hmm. So they're sitting in this room in a library, and this professor gets up, who probably got tons of money, to fund his center. And he says, the oceans are getting more acidic. So in the middle of the talk, I said, really? I said, can you tell me the pH of the oceans? He goes, well, I think they're getting less basic. I said, the oceans can never be acidic. Okay? Because if you take a bunch of salt water, you know, you'd have to, you'd have to drop, you can't get it acidic. So he said, no. I meant to say they're getting less basic. Well, I said, what's the pH? He didn't want to answer that. So they cut me off. Anyway, the talk goes on, 150 people. And the end of it, he goes, and the ocean levels are rising. And I go, that is absolutely false. They call the police, Dan. The Andover police had to come and the whole meeting was shut down. It's all on video.
That's amazing.
So this is, you know, and this is a liberal community where Black Lives Matter. And I was the only dark-skinned guy there who was raising questions. Mm-hmm. I mean, the contradictions are quite profound. The only guy probably with 4 degrees from MIT who studied the physics of it. More importantly, people need to understand there is no field called climate change. There's no field called climate science. It's nonsense. It doesn't exist. There is no field. It's a made up field. The real issue is if you want to, the people who actually know climate are applied mathematicians who must have two skill sets, either fluid mechanics and fluid dynamics or radiative physics. Because what you're looking at is a complex system of fluids, two interacting fluids, the ocean, a liquid fluid, and gases, another kind of fluid, right? Which is the atmosphere. And then the fact that radiative physics is going, you've got all these chemicals, the sun hits it, and how they radiate, move particles. That's really, quote unquote, climate science. But there is no field. So overnight, you have a bunch of people who become climate scientists. It doesn't exist.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, where the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away. I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today. Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land.
God bless the USA.